Good afternoon. This is Primrose Zenga and Caroline Livingstone interviewing Dr. Karen Bruin at Barrett the Honors College on 22 February 2019 for the program Barrett at 30. Good afternoon, Dr. Bruin.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Bruin, can you tell us about your training in other places you taught before coming to Barrett?
Well, I got my PhD and my MA at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in religious studies with emphasis on the history of the Christian traditions. I got my BA at Hunter College in New York City. I was a non-traditional student. I had gone to college in the Midwest, you know, after high school, as a theater major, but I dropped out when I got a job in theater, and then I just was in the Midwest and in New York acting, and then I decided that was no way to grow old, so I went back to school when I was 34.
Wow, so you're a non-traditional student, that's very interesting. And so after that, I was wondering when and why you chose to join Barrett.
Well, I was finishing up my PhD, and my thesis advisor saw a job for Barrett posted, and he said, you ought to apply for this. And as it turned out, I had a childhood friend who had married and settled in Tempe. And I thought, oh, if I get an interview, I'll get a free trip to see my friend. So I did, and I did.
Well, that is very good. So, can you also tell us a little bit about your current position, how you came to it, how long you've been in it, and its place in your Barrett experience?
Okay. Well, I currently am the interim faculty chair, but that's only for this year because the duly elected chair had to step down. I've been the chair before, and so that's why I was chosen to fill in this year. I was the original Barrett Dean's Fellow, and when I stepped down from being chair in 2013, and Peggy Nelson was still the vice dean, as Barrett grew, her job was growing, and she saw an opportunity to kind of hand off some of her duties to me. So I took on some of her duties, but remain teaching. So I was half-time teaching and half-time kind of administration, and they didn't know what to call me, and we finally landed on Dean's Fellow.
Oh, that's very good. And if I may ask, what year was this? When did you join Barrett?
I joined Barrett in 1998. I became a Dean's Fellow in 2013.
Oh. So, you published an in-depth article on the origins and development and serving, as you called it, the Human Events Seminar to Students at Barrett in the anthology Pursuit of Excellence in a Networked Society. So how does teaching the Human Event influence the pursuit of excellence at Barrett?
Well, I'm going to answer that in two parts. Let me tell you how it's influenced me and my pursuit of excellence. I feel like it's been this incredible gift to be able to remain a student in my professional career, you know, to earn a living and to be able to continue to learn and grow and help others learn and grow. And so I think that the way that the human event contributes to excellence is that it is an opportunity for students, it's a space for students to just use their minds, you know, and to just think and reason and discuss and be wrong and get your mind changed. And that's an incredible privilege to have, and it's, I think, an even greater privilege to be able to oversee it, you know, to be the facilitator.
And if you don't mind, how do you believe that your experience as a non-traditional student has changed how you teach people in the classroom?
Well, I think I'm probably pretty immature, so I don't know how, you know, when I came here, I don't know that I was that different than my colleagues, but certainly as I've gotten older, and, you know, I'm older, I think there's only one faculty member who's older than me. It's just given me some perspective on students. I have a son who just turned 17, so I have a whole new understanding of who the students are and what they're going through.
That's amazing. So you say that teaching the human event has allowed you to keep on being a student.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second part to my question of pursuit of excellence was also for faculty, so not just you, but the rest of your fellow faculty. How do you think that the human event has influenced their pursuit of excellence?
Well, I mean, in the academy, in professional academia, being a generalist, knowing something about a lot of things, is not that highly valued. Academics are encouraged to be narrow and deep. So we're a bit of an anomaly here at Barrett, and it takes a certain kind of person to want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, my office is next door to an evolutionary biologist, and so I have those conversations that if I were in a religious studies department, I would not have. Now, I think the academy is kind of catching up to us, and more of these sort of transdisciplinary projects are being encouraged, but we've been doing it for a long time.
You mentioned in this essay that the mandate to grow enrollment by 2013 to 6,000 students posed possible challenges to the effective delivery of the human event. Can you expand on that? Like how, what kind of challenges are you foreseeing?
Well, we've wanted to have unity and comparability without having uniformity because, you know, the evolutionary biologist has different strengths and he should draw from his strengths when he teaches in the same way that I have strengths and we all have strengths. So the challenge has been, how can we offer comparable experiences that are not identical?
And so increasing the students to 6,000, how would that make it?
Well, when I first came here, I think I was the sixth or seventh faculty hired. We achieved that, you know, unity without uniformity by talking in the hallways. You know, we didn't have policies or procedures. We just kind of figured it out. But as we grew, that became no longer possible. And so we had to figure out ways to standardize it and, you know, give some institutional history, things like that.
How do you think Barrett has done in growing across all four of the campuses? Do you think they've done a good job of maintaining that, like, central idea of Barrett?
I hope so. You know, it's very difficult for everyone, mostly because of distance. I don't think, for example, I think we do a better job of being connected to downtown here at Tempe than we do on the other campuses, not because we think differently about them, but they're just so far away. I mean, to go to West is, even if you are driving, it's at least an hour each way. You know, it's an afternoon if you want to go see somebody teach a class or just have coffee with one of your colleagues. And that's hard. And so I think technology will be our friend at Barrett. We're still figuring it out the way I think everybody else is. So I think we've done a good job. I think we could do a better job. I think we're trying to do a better job.
That's great. So 5 years later, has that goal been met? The enrollment
goal? No, it hasn't been met. I mean, you mean about the four campuses?
So the 6,000 students. So you're mandated to enroll and increase the students to 6,000. Has that goal been met?
Oh, yes, that's been met. That was easy.
That is good to know. And how is Barrett faculty adjusted in order to accommodate the growing student body?
Well, we've grown. I mean, in, I think it was 2014 or 2015, mm-hmm. we hired 14 faculty.
Oh, wow.
And that I was on that search committee. And I mean, that's just incredible. We had to, of course, you know, look at all the applications, make those kinds of choices, interview them, have them have campus visits. Then we had 14 new faculty. How do you mentor
mm-hmm.
14 faculty? Usually when you hire, you get maybe three, mostly one or two. And that's a very different mentoring experience than 14. How do we convey that idea of comparability without uniformity? Things those. I mean, it was challenging.
So you're talking about mentoring the faculty who
mm-hmm.
were hired. Can you share with us a little bit about how that program goes of mentoring faculty?
Well, it is rather what the program looked like when there were 14 mentees
mm-hmm.
looks different than when there are three mentees. But the principles, the underlying principles remain the same. We want to support these young scholars as they become generalists, as they expand. A lot of them are newly minted PhDs, and they're used to, you know, just writing about a very narrow topic, you know, very deeply. So through workshops, through meetings with their mentor, with meetings with the faculty chair, we give them resources and are there to answer questions about what it means to expand. You know, what does it, for example,
uh-huh.
I teach in my 272, I teach Sigmund Freud, right? Because
uh-huh.
he's a foundational thinker. Now, in my PhD program, I read what he had to say about religion.
Uh-huh.
But that's all I knew about Freud.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I first started teaching, that's what I put on my syllabus. But as I, you know, as I expanded and grew, I realized that really there were better things to put on my syllabus given my goals.
Mm-hmm.
And I got there from asking the other faculty what they taught from Freud and why, and having those conversations. So we would just want to provide a structure for new faculty. Their mentor would probably go over student evaluations with them. And, you know, student evaluations are usually fine, but we want to make sure that the new faculty is contextualizing them appropriately. Because, you know, you can get 49 great evaluations and one not so great. And, of course, you know, you have a tendency to focus on that not so great. And so, you know, just older, more experienced voices to help this person professionalize, go from being a student to being a professional.
A few years ago, you won a Faculty Achievement Teaching Award
mm-hmm.
For teaching the human event at Barrett. Can you share that experience with us?
Well, I have one of my colleagues, Jackie Scott Lynch, to thank. I mean, she nominated me and did all the heavy lifting of writing a, you know, really supportive letter. But it was a really great experience. I mean, we got to go to a really posh resort for the dinner. And I wasn't the only person honored. There was a best teacher, best researcher, best service. And then they give two alumni awards.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the alums, and of course I can't remember his name, but he was a former NFL player. He'd been successful.
Mm-hmm.
And now he and his wife run a nonprofit school for special needs kids. It was just so inspiring, you know. And I was like, I am on the same stage with this guy. I mean, he was, and of course I can't remember his name, but that's what I really remember about it was, you know, just being surrounded by excellence.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So you worked with Dr. Nelson, and she talked about how you worked with her to develop the Honors Faculty Advisors Program.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that like? What did you have to put in place?
Well, you know, when you have an institution within an institution, you have to find ways to situate yourself correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't do what we do if we didn't have allies in the units you know, I'm not a biochemist, and yet many of my students are going to want to write their thesis in biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So I and all my colleagues have to have some sort of path to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the faculty honors advisors are, you know, professors within the units who
mm-hmm.
value working with undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
And really all we, and that's the most important thing, and they already had that, but we have, we've provided a structure
mm-hmm.
and a support, you know, not, we don't give them very much money at all, but, you know, just, I wrote, I'm actually very proud of this.
Mm-hmm.
Last summer, I put together this, which is the handbook for all the faculty honors advisors. And it has things like, this is how students get their credit. And this is what happens if a student wants to do a project not in your unit. And this is how you contact other people. And these are the T's that need to be crossed and I's that need to be dotted. So it's providing support for faculty in the unit that work with honors students.
So the book is called The Faculty Honors Advisors Handbook, and this is available to all faculty honors advisors in
yes.
all other departments.
Yes.
And when was this printed, or when did you write this?
I did it over, I mean, when I say I wrote it, I did write a lot of the documents in here, but mostly last summer it was a matter of pulling them together.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we would email them, oh, here's a checklist for creating a good honors contract, and here's a way to access the honors fund, and I wanted to get it all in one place. So
mm-hmm.
I put it together
mm-hmm.
last summer, the summer of 2018.
Mm. So do you think that putting together this book is in any way similar to the work that you were doing with Dr. Nelson before you had a book and working
yes,
around?
Absolutely. I mean, because some of the documents she wrote, and we talked about everything that went in here,
mm-hmm.
and we talked about everything that went out to the faculty honors advisors. We wanted to make sure that we were consistently on message.
Mm-hmm.
There is such a thing as too much information,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we had to decide what they needed to know and what they didn't need to know, because we could take care of it for them,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
What do you think makes a faculty member a good honors advisor?
Well, obviously they have to have some sort of enthusiasm for working with students, not just their own research. But they also have to have an in-depth understanding of their own department. Because, as we all know, writing a thesis in biochemistry is not the same as writing a thesis in art history. So the art history advisor needs to understand who her colleagues are and what they're doing, so that she can match the student up with an appropriate thesis director, or help that student choose classes that are going to take them where they want to go in terms of the thesis.
So just as a follow-up, so how has the Honors Faculty Advisors Program evolved?
Well, I mean, when Dean Nelson started it, I think there were maybe 20 or 30, and now there's over 100.
Mm-hmm.
So we try and get somebody from each unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the things that these faculty honors advisors have to do is compose a document about what the requirements in their unit are for a thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And then we post those in a central place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's harder to get 100 plus faculty to do that than it was to get 20 faculty to do that.
Absolutely.
And again, you know, unity without uniformity. I mean, that's always the battle cry.
Absolutely. And so, given the current status, how do you envision it going into the future, the program?
I think that heretofore, it's been about the FHA connecting with their students, mm-hmm. you know, and providing mm-hmm. support for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we are going to have to start asking them to be more connected to their fellow faculty members, like advocate for Barrett in their faculty meetings, be a source of knowledge when one of their colleagues comes in and says, so what do I have to do if I'm going to have an honors contract, or what's the bureaucracy of teaching an honors section? I think that the honors faculty advisors are going to have to be more involved in that end.
Why?
Because it's getting too big for one or two people to do it. In the past, whoever it was would say, well, I don't really know how to do an honors contract. The FHA would say, oh, well, you know, email Karen Bruin, she'll help you.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I will, but it gets to the point where one person isn't enough. And
mm-hmm.
so we have to disseminate the knowledge a little bit.
So Barrett is the only residency honors college in the nation, as well as the biggest honors college in the country overall. How do you think it fares with Ivy League colleges?
Well, I never went to an Ivy League college, so I don't really know. I know it's a lot cheaper. My husband went to Ivy League colleges for his undergraduate and graduate degree, and he's always talking about how this experience really is comparable and in some ways even surpasses that, because he went to Yale as an undergrad, and Yale has a definition.
Mm-hmm.
When you walk in the door, you know, there are certain parameters that are there. Not bad ones, but they're there. And Barrett's parameters are a lot more fluid,
mm-hmm.
you know.
I asked this question because President Crow said that Barrett was modeled against the Ivy League
mm-hmm.
Model,
mm-hmm.
but supposed to deliver more. And so my question to you is, having been here since 1998,
mm-hmm.
was a very long time, how do you see that having filtered into the system and what?
Well, when we got our own campus, that was on the path of becoming like an Ivy. I think the low student to teacher ratio
mm-hmm.
is comparable to the Ivy, the advising system, the student affairs programming. I mean, those are all comparable to being an Ivy. The students are comparable to Ivy League students in terms of scores and what they do after graduation. Where I think we offer more is just about that sort of fluidity and expansiveness I was talking about. We are able to meet the student where they are in terms of helping them be, you know, I was going to say achieve their goals. And I mean, of course, we all want to achieve our goals.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a spirit of Barrett that goes beyond that. It's about be the best you can be.
Mm-hmm.
Of course we want you to get your dream job. And, you know, of course we want that for you. But you're probably going to get that. How can we help you be the best person that you can be? And I think that is plays more of a role in Barrett's vision for its students than maybe it does in the Ivies.
Hmm.
I haven't been to an Ivy, so I can't really say.
Neither have I. I'm having a good experience here.
I'm glad.
So my question, I think, in a follow-up to that would be, are there areas that you feel Barrett could improve, and what would they be?
I think that Barrett could have a stronger message that would calm the students down. I've seen students in the last 20 years get more and more anxious about the world. And maybe they're right. Maybe they're right to be more anxious about the world. But I think we could do a better job of saying, it's going to be okay. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be okay. Relax. Remember, I teach mostly freshmen, and they're just terrified when they get here. And they're more terrified than they used to be. I guess the world is a scarier place.
How do you suggest that is done?
Well, you know, when I came here, there was no such thing as Facebook. There was no such thing as social media. We barely had email, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, so the world was smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a big one, social media.
Mm-hmm.
And how social media constructs an ideal identity, or how we try and construct our own ideal identities,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and the pressure that puts us under.
Mm-hmm. So Barrett could incorporate that into the teaching? Like, how would Barrett help students to calm them down in view of this?
To help them understand that their public profile is a persona, not who they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's, instead of concentrating on building that persona,
mm-hmm,
or participating in that, let's spend more time figuring out who you really are.
Looking more inwards than outwards.
Yeah, inward, and less emphasis on how it looks.
Mm-hmm.
How, I think students are very anxious about how they present themselves, with good reason. I think, you know, I think the world puts a lot of emphasis on that. But if we can get students to understand who they are and understand the value of who they are,
mm-hmm,
then I think they're a lot less anxious about presenting themselves.
Barrett is a leader in delivering a multidisciplinary curriculum to thousands of students, which I think makes it an authority in the setup and delivery of top-class education at a reasonable price. How can Barrett use this authority to become a leader in the provision of a rounded educational experience?
Well, I think we're looking at a great opportunity for that as our reputation grows. And I think our message has to be more than simply, we have, you know, great dorms and great student programs.
Uh-huh.
Our message has to be, we have a particular commitment to a multidisciplinary education.
Uh-huh.
And I think that the way we approach education is important on two levels. Number one, I think it makes you a better person.
Uh-huh.
And number two, there's a transactional sort of practical aspect to being able to look at a problem from multiple perspectives,
mm-hmm,
being able to listen to people who maybe don't come from the same place as you, either culturally or professionally,
mm-hmm,
being able to engage in that conversation, having enough confidence in yourself to know that you are not your proposal.
Mm-hmm.
So, if people want to criticize your proposal, that's okay. Let's all be here together and learn. I mean, I think we have that kind of education,
mm-hmm,
makes for better citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we're a public institution. We should be producing good citizens.
Oh, that's good. And so, Barrett, you're 30. You've been here 20 of those 30.
That's right.
Where do you see Barrett in the future?
That's a good question. Well, not with me, because I'm going to retire. But in 10 years, I think that they will have a different relationship to technology, and I hope that, you know, they're able to harness technology and,
mm-hmm,
use it to provide students a better experience, not just an easier one. I think that they will have, or they should have, stronger connections to the disciplinary units than they have now. And they're strong, but I think that connection needs to be even stronger. I think that they will have more of a national profile than they do now, even.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you've mentioned technology twice.
Mm-hmm.
First, in regards to students' anxiety to the world,
mm-hmm.
and now about Barrett providing a better experience for the students in
mm-hmm.
regards to technology. How has technology evolved at Barrett since you've been here in 1998?
When I came here in 98, I got my first computer in like 92, you know? When I came here, I had my own laptop. It cost $2,500. You know, nobody had a computer. You know, the students might go to the computer lab. When I taught on study abroad, we would say, leave your computer at home. You're not going to be able to use it, and they're just going to steal it. Now I can't imagine a student going anywhere without some electronic
mm-hmm.
device that helps with their education. So what I'm really thinking about is online education. I really think about that a lot, because online education, this is one thing that I hope we improve on. Online education reaches people that otherwise would not have access to this kind of education. And I think we have a moral obligation to try and reach those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that technology will help us do that.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, technology can be a cash cow for educational institutions. Just, you know, round them up, you know, get them online, you know, get that degree, thank you for your money. And so we have to negotiate that.
Absolutely. So you talked about your teaching study abroad
mm-hmm.
courses, and
mm-hmm.
I think that's very much in line with Barrett trying to be
mm-hmm.
part of the
mm-hmm.
global village. So what courses have you taught, and how have they affected your experience of being at Barrett?
Well, I've taught a few times in the London, Dublin, and Edinburgh program, because my own research is on England.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've also taught in the Greece and Italy program, because I'm, you know, fairly well informed about the ancient world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, one place you can study
mm-hmm.
the ancient world. One thing that I've noticed, because lots of colleges go to London and Rome and Florence in the summer and Athens, it only makes me appreciate our students even more. I mean, not only are they smart and polite, but they're just intellectually curious in a way that I don't see other students always being. I can't tell you how many times there's been some sort of class activity that, you know, there's some sort of tour or something, and the tour guide starts out on his or her spiel, and the students will go, oh yeah, we know that. This is blah, 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 you know, and the tour guide is like, well, okay, I guess I don't need to talk. I mean, a colleague of mine used to say, you can only be 19 and in Paris once. And it's true, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the other people that spend a lot of time abroad? Retirees. And the retirees' experience is, oh, this is a lot like Pittsburgh. You know, they're comparing it to their own experience, whereas the young person is experiencing it on its own terms. That's fun
mm-hmm.
to be a part of.
Yeah, and I noticed that you're also very widely published.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Well, you're published quite a bit. Could we say that?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So you're published quite a bit, and some of it, if not most of it, has been once you were already at Barrett. So how
yes.
has been being at Barrett and nurturing your own writing as a scholar? How has that affected?
Well, teaching students how to write has certainly made me a better writer.
Mm-hmm.
Not a faster writer, though. I'm not a faster writer. I've just had to carve out the time, you know. It's mostly that, you know. It's mostly finding the time. Dean Nelson was very good about figuring out a system of teaching load that could support faculty who wanted to publish, but the publishing always had to have some connection to our teaching, which it did.
Well, Dr. Brune, I think those are all the questions that we had for you today, but should you think of anything else that you'd like us to know or any question that you have, you can contact Vice Dean Food or Dr. Boyce Chacino or Matthew Jensted, and we will arrange another time to sit down again over those questions. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Good luck with this project. It's an important one.
Thank you. Please, like you, well, obviously, from when I'm talking to you, I realize that you genuinely care about Barrett. I mean, this could have been in another college. Why do you care?
Because I think it really offers something very valuable.
Hmm.
You know, I'm a little smug sometimes. You know, I look at the world today and I think, oh my God, I should be doing more. You know, I should be out there on the front lines, or I should, you know, live in a tiny apartment so that I can give all my money to these really worthy causes. And then I find myself not willing to do that. But I always tell myself, but you know what?
Mm-hmm.
You are teaching bright kids how to be in the world. That's worth something, right? You never know. You never know. You know, I might be teaching the next president of the United States, or somebody who's going to go be a diplomat, or somebody who's going to figure out a new way to feed people who don't have enough to eat. So I'm lucky that way.
So you have that much confidence in your students?
Most of them. Most days.
Dr. Brune, once again, thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you for sitting down with us.